getting it, we would like to salute tonight a major cockamamie fake of our time. And we've had a few in our time, haven't we? Have you ever, watching Watergate and I'm watching all this stuff, you know, and it's really fantastic. Here's a little story that you may find, it's just really typical today. Have you ever had a feeling that you've been in the hands of charlatans? No, I mean, really seriously, have you ever gone into a place where you thought what was going on was legitimate? And then you begin to get the suspicion that something was totally fake. You couldn't pinpoint it. You couldn't put your finger on it. Well, I had an experience like that here a couple of semesters ago, which I will not go into. But very, very enlightening. Very enlightening. And, you know, it's easy to fall into that today. Well, I'll just read the piece to you, and you can just make your own mind up. It's a piece. Well, listen. The lecturer was Dr. Myron L. Fox, an authority on the application of mathematics to human behavior. His topic, mathematical game theory, as applied to physical education. His credentials, impressive. His audience, 55 medical educators, psychologists, psychiatrists, educational administrators. And he delivered a major address in a major institution before legitimate people and pulled it off. And on a topic like mathematical game theory as applied to physical education. Now, that sounds very official, doesn't it? The only problem with the above scene, which actually took place, was that Dr. Myron L. Fox was a fraud, a professional actor decked out with phony degrees and publications to seem respectable. He had been coached to present his topic and conduct the question and answer period with, quote, an excessive use of double talk, neologism, non sequiturs, and contradictory statements. All this was to be interspersed with parenthetical humor, meaningless references to unrelated topics, reported his coaches. Dr. Fox was part of an elaborate scheme devised by three medical educators to find out whether an audience can be seduced by the style of its presentation. Do you hear what they're doing? In other words, if you have a certain style, you can get away with damn near anything. And they wanted to find out if it would work in a genuine technical subject, a style. Well, they wanted to find out. They were right. Not one of the 55 expert victims of the hoax recognized it. And one claimed that he had read Dr. Fox's publication. His non-existent books that he had written. How do you like that? Even so, not all of the victims were impressed by what Dr. Fox said, but with Dr. Fox. One thought that the presentation was, quote, too intellectual. Another described him as being somewhat disorganized. But I'll tell you this. If you had Einstein addressing 55 guys, out of 55 guys, three or four of them would have some complaints, especially if they're educators themselves. You know, this is an endemic thing. So, yeah, that was pretty fantastic. But overall, reported the authors of the study, the 55 subjects, quote, responded favorably at a significant level to an 8-item questionnaire concerning their attitudes towards the lecture. The authors of the study were Donald H. Naftulin, director of the Division of Continuing Education and Psychiatry at the University of Southern California, John E. Ware, a professor of medical education at Southern Illinois University, and Frank A. Donnelly, instructor of psychiatry at the University of Southern California. That's pretty impressive. It says their hypothesis was that given a sufficiently, quote, impressive lecturer, an environment of the lecturer, for the lecturer, even experienced experts participating in a new learning experience can be seduced into feeling satisfied that they have learned, despite irrelevant, conflicting, and meaningless content conveyed by the lecturer. But he has to have fine style. I've said this for years. I have, in fact, that brings up, you know, that brings up a point. How, I just wonder how much actual content of practically, and by the way, on converse, the reverse is also true. You could get a really great expert who, if he has poor style, would be often denounced as a fraud and a phony, and then put him down. In other words, the style is all. Proust, you know, said it. Proust made this comment. That was a very great line, you know. It's all style, vanity. So that's what it's about. And if you can get really a great performer, a good performer, not a great performer, good performer's coached, he knows what he's doing, he knows how, he has confidence on his feet. Believe me, he can lecture anybody and get by with it. It was just a smattering of insight. Well, in fact, one of the great frauds of all time. What was the name of that great fraud? Remember, Life magazine did stories on him? In fact, they did a movie starring Tony Curtis on him. He had successfully taught higher mathematics. What was his name? Fred DeMera. That's right. And in fact, he even became, he was a surgeon. That's how they tripped him up. He was performing operations. And then when they gave him a they didn't trip him up because the operation was wrong. They tripped him up because they were going to give him a high naval award. And somehow they took out his records, you know, to put it on his records in the Navy. He had joined the Navy as a fraud. And it turned out that he was not this doctor at all. He had a different, totally different name. And that's how they caught him. He could still be, you know, performing upper lobotomies with no apparent problems. But now you see, I feel that that this happens far more than we would ever guess. Now, we know of the guys that were caught, but I think this happens far more than we guess. And I'm going to tell you a little story now. I think the 7-year limitation of guilt clause has taken effect here. But a few years ago, when I first came to New York, and this is a story I don't think I've ever told on the air. Now, you ready for this one? A few years ago, when I first came to New York, I was out, you know, doing acting. I was acting jobs, and I was out on the street, freelancing, struggling like hell to get a foothold in the scene here. And I had this agent. I don't even remember the guy's name anymore. The little cockamamie little agent, a true phone booth Indian. You know, he's a sharp little guy on the phone, constantly in and out of the office, yelling and hollering. And there was always a crowd of guys waiting in the anteroom of his little office, guys holding trained beagles on their laps and seals that played the bugle. Oh, it was fantastic. So if you've never been through that scene, you wouldn't really appreciate the quality of it. I remember one day sitting in his office, they said, there's a big crowd. It's a crowd of totally, they look like people out of a George Price New Yorker cartoon, you know, the kind with the earmuffs and the sousaphone and all that stuff. And this girl is sitting next to me, and she was Oriental. And I said, what do you do? I figured she's an actress. And she says, I play stag shows. I said, you do what? She says, yes, I play stag shows. I said, oh, I see. And in other words, my booker was booking stag shows. You know the ladies that make the brief but spectacular appearance at various stag shows. And so, you know, it's purely a profession with her. So we're sitting there waiting for our moments. And finally, I get in to see the guy. We talk a little bit. And finally, he says, yeah, see what he can do for me. So a couple of days later, I get pictures and all that stuff. A couple of days later, I get a call from this guy. And I was living in this cheesy Times Square hotel at the time. You know, you just have to live the life of the sleazy Broadway life for a year or so to really know it. Now you can go through Times Square. You can see the drugstores and the porny jobs and all that. You can walk past the bookstores and the movie houses. This is not the same. You can even go in them once in a while. But when you live there. I mean, okay, how many times you've seen The Midnight Cowboy, man? It doesn't even come near it. And I was living right, you know, here I am, I'm living in this cheesy hotel. So the phone rings downstairs. They didn't even have phones in a room, no way. See, so the phone rings apparently downstairs at the desk. And the way they worked it was any time the phone rang, the elevator guy would go up in the elevator and he'd holler down the corridor, whoever was running on the phone, see? So I hear, Shelby, you're running the phone. So I said, okay, so I came out and I go down. I said, oh, boy, what is it now? What now? Because I never got any calls. See, at this point, I was really scratching. So I went down the elevator and I picked up the phone at the desk and I said, yeah. And, hello, this is Manny. Now get over here quick. I said, well, what the hell? Oh, who? Manny, the agent, get over here, you fun nut, get over here. So I hang up and I run down the street. The agent's got a call. I figured, oh, this is my big break, see? So I run down the street and I go up 18 flights of stairs to this crummy little office with the people sitting around with the trained seals on their laps and stuff. And I go in and I said, hey, Manny, what's up, see? And Manny's sitting at his desk there looking, you know, very official. He says, here. He says, take this and look it over. And he's got a script. I think, oh, by God, you know, it's great. So I take the script and I go back outside to the ante room and I sit down and I start reading it. And I can't figure what the hell this is all about. It's apparently a lecture. And it is a lecture. It's a lecture. And the lecture apparently had to do with a high compression V8 engine. Yes. And it was particularly concerned with the carburation of this high-compression V8 engine. And the lecture was apparently to other people who knew about the high-compression V8 engines, because it was filled with all kinds of interesting mathematical allusions, and there were points all along. It says, present slide. It would say, at this point, slide. It had little things like that, see? So I brought the thing back in, and he says, what do you think of it? I said, well, are you sure you gave me the right thing, Manny? I mean, you know, this is a lecture here. He said, yeah, what do you think of that? What do you think of it? And I said, well, it's pretty good, I guess. He said, well, he says, I want you to go over and see these guys. Here's the address. And he gives me a card with the address of a place over on the east side, which is a side of town I didn't get to very often those days. So I go across town by foot, and incidentally, Manny says, don't forget to wear your suit, wear your best joint, put on a dark tie, and I want you to have your hair combed, and get your, for God's sake, shine your shoes, will you? So there I go. You know, I go back to my hotel room. I put on my only suit, which is a dark suit and a white shirt, and I put on a tie, my dark tie. I had no idea what this was. And so I went across town to the number, and it was in one of the big major buildings in New York. Okay? Let's put it this way, comparable to the Seagram building, one of these big, elegant, fantastic buildings. Up I go in the elevator, and I arrive out in front of this room, and here were a whole series of numbered offices, just numbers. Number 7920, we'll say. Big, beautiful oaken door. She was really, really plush. And so I open the door, and here's a girl sitting in there with a pink telephone. And she's apparently a little reception room. Very quiet and plush. And I walk up to the desk, and I said, excuse me, I'm supposed to... She said, your name? And I give her my name. She said, you'll be next in just a moment. Just to have a seat, please. So I sit down, and here all around on the coffee table with these very elegant magazines, Wall Street Journal, Forbes, Business Week, Advertising Monthly, and all these very official magazines. So I sit down, and I'm the only guy there at this point, see? Well, five minutes go by, and the door opens, and out comes another guy, obviously an actor. I could see he was a fellow actor. He had this look on his face. You just know each other. It's a curious... you know each other. And he's got a copy of the script, too, and he's being ushered out. And there's a man standing there in the doorway, very elegant gentleman. He says, well, he said, if we decide, we'll give you a call. Gubbard there got your number there? And she said, yes, I have his number. All right, thank you very much. Well, who's next? And there I am. And so the girl says, Mr. Shepherd here. So he said, oh, good afternoon, Mr. Shepherd. We're certainly pleased to meet you. Would you come right in? And I step into the room. I figure they're casting a play or something. You know, I've got the script. And I walk into the room, and here, sitting in this room, it's a conference room, big table. And there's about seven or eight guys who look exactly like they're out of a Class B movie starring Edward Arnold, you know, some movie about big business. These are tycoons, out of executive suites, silver hair, all huge guys, you know, smoking expensive cigars. And they're sitting around this table. And the man who's in charge says to me, he says, "Well, gentlemen, this is Mr. Shepard. Mr. Shepard is here to read for us. Would you please step up to the front of the room there so the gentlemen can all take a good look at you?" So all these guys are looking at me, you know. They're craning their necks. They're just looking me up and down, looking at my shoes and my suit and all. And the man in charge never gave me his name. He said, "All right." He said, "But begin to read." He said, "We'd like to hear how you sound. We know that you haven't had time to memorize the continuity, but just give us a little reading there." And so I said, "All right, fine." I said, "Excuse me, one thing first. What kind of a character? Do you want this man to be a teacher or what?" "Not exactly. Let's say he's a young corporation engineer, and he's talking to other engineers. How about that?" I says, "Oh, very good." So I picked up the script and I started to read. It says, "Gentlemen, we're here today to take a look at the new development in our engineering department on this V8 number 722 engine. Later on, there'll probably be a lot of questions from most of you about production problems that we're going to have to face when we put this engine into production, cost overage problems, that sort of thing. We will have a question and answer period, and that will be conducted by Mr. Sylvester L. Gumpox, Dr. Sylvester Gumpox, who, as you know, is the head of the research department, and he'll be along here to answer any questions you have. Now, as you know, I'm from the developmental department. Our tack is to develop new equipment, new engines, and I'm not really particularly concerned with production here this afternoon. I'm talking mostly about theory. Now, would you please show us the first slide? I'd like to show you the engine, which has not yet been unwrapped. We've not shown this to the press. This is the first showing of the engine itself. This is the prototype model. We may have the first side, the slide, please." And then there was a little thing on the script that said slide. And then I said, "Now, you'll notice the low profile of this engine. We've tried to keep the profile of it low. We've tried to maintain a low center of gravity for stylistic reasons. You'll notice also, too, that below the gas chamber there, and as you notice, below the water pump, that's been redesigned, and you notice the fins have been added to give added cooling. In fact, our tests show that 0.0037 degrees of coolant is obtained per mile per hour at the maximum torque on this engine. Now, well, it was a script." And then he says, "Okay, fine." After I read about 15, maybe 20 lines of it, he says, "Okay." He says, "Hold on a minute." He says, "Fine." He said, "Would you wait outside?" And I went out to the ante room, and he sat down. I totally missed the sign. And I sat in the ante room, and about 5 minutes later, I was sitting there, you know, looking at the girl. She kept looking at me and answering the phone. About 5 minutes later, the man came to the script and said, "Would you please come with me?" I walked back into the room, and the three guys said, "Well, I think you'll do fine. We've made the decision. You're going to be it. Now, your name, when you use this script, will be Mr. And I'm inventing a name here. I won't use the actual name. Your name is Dr. Clarence Youngson. And you live just outside of Detroit, but don't get into that. Your name is Dr. Youngson, and you've been with the firm for 3.5 years. And that this is your first appearance before these men. Now, if you have any questions about this character, we have Mr. Clifford, who will give you further briefing on it." Well, I sat with Mr. Clifford then, who was another guy that came in, and the other three left. They went on to their important lunch. And he was a very dynamic type. And I talked to Mr. Clifford for about an hour about this script and various things I should and shouldn't say, where I should get into it deeper and shouldn't, and so on. And he said, okay. He said, go home. He said, read the script over. He said, we want you to deliver it verbatim. We don't want anybody reading off the paper now. You can carry it with you. You can pretend like you're refreshing your notes from time to time if you do run into problems. But we want it to be delivered as if it's from memory. And I said, okay. So I took the script back to my hotel room, and then I called Manny. I said, Manny, what the hell is this? Manny says, you got the job. I said, I do indeed. He says, okay. He says, there's $150 in it for you. He says, of course, I'll take my usual 10% off the top, plus 5% expenses. You know, all these phone calls back and forth and having this thing mimeographed. I said, okay, thank you, Manny. This is my first job. So I was really excited. So I sat down and I read this thing over and over and over again until finally, by about 4 in the morning, I figured I had it down pretty cold. The whole kit and caboodle was a half an hour script. Well, they had given me a number where I was to appear the next day. Another building, another room number, and a whole set of different circumstances. So sure enough, the next morning I arrived at this building, very impressive building in Midtown Manhattan, up to the 10th floor. And they had a kind of a cocktail party set up. It was doing these people were drinking drinks and so on. And I arrived at the, and Mr. Clifford was there. And he says, oh, yes. He says, Dr. Youngson, we're certainly pleased to see you. You made it. How was your trip out? And I said, fine. I said, oh, it was a good flight. And he said, by God, he says, I hate that flight from Detroit. He said, that can get very awful rough at this time of the year. And I said, yeah, well, Dr. Youngson, I'd like you to meet Mr. Watanabe here, and over here is Mr. Fig Newton, and you've heard these men, heard of all these men. I said, yes, good to see you. And they're, oh, yeah, they're big cheers. And I said, well, we might as well get going, gentlemen. All set, let's go. And we walked into the next room, which was a presentation room. Had a screen, a beaded screen, a lectern, the whole bit. And I stepped up to the lectern, and I said, gentlemen, we're here today to have our first look at the new eight-cylinder, the new V8 high-compression engine, number 6 SJ7 GT, which has been under wraps. We've been holding this under wraps now for, as you know, for 8 months. There's been a lot of question about it, and you're being privileged to be the first to see this this engine, providing, of course, that the plan, the budget, and our projected plans are approved by the board. And, of course, a lot of what you have to say is going to mean the difference in that, fellas. And, of course, I'm doing it right off the script, see? And they're sitting there, there's about 40 or 50 very official-looking guys. So I proceeded, and I said, may I have the first slide, please? And, chunk, down came the slide, and there's this engine. I had a pointer. I said, now, you'll notice the cooling pan has been changed, the low profile that we have on this new engine. This is for styling problems. As you know, the long, slim hood is one of the more important concepts of our next year's styling, so we're going to have a low profile on this engine. We've been able to do that by dropping the pan down, and I'm pointing away there. See, it went fantastic. I really began to dig it. I really loved it. I was walking around there, you know. I was Dr. Young, and I was talking about this fantastic new high-compression V8 engine. I was discussing hemispherical combustion chambers, and I was going, talking about all kinds of new magnesium alloy camshafts that we've worked out using various types of formulae, and it's going on and on. Well, when it was over, I said, now, gentlemen, that's the presentation. Dr. Bullard, the head of our department, will be here shortly. I see him in the doorway now. And I had been briefed that the guy that would come in immediately when I followed and stand in the doorway wearing the big white carnation would be Dr. Bullard. And I said, there he is in the doorway. Let's give him a hand. He's the man that's responsible for this. And they all cheered. Hey, 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 hey. See? So at that point, I said, now I'd like to, you know, I've been really having a good time up here, and I'd like to answer any of your questions. But I'm going to turn it over now to the man that headed the whole project himself. Dr. Bullard, come on in, Doc. And he walked in. He says, good to see you. Good to see you, Clarence. How was your flight out? And I said, oh, fine. He said, well, he said, too bad you've got to take that next flight back. Say hello to the crowd at the plant. I said, okay, Doc. He said, wish me luck. And I said, good luck, Doc. Oh, these are great guys. So I walked out. Big cheer. I get this fantastic cheer. I go out now. The door is closed. Now I'm outside. And Mr. Clifford is there. He says, fantastic. Great job. Great job, kid. Here. Just great job. He says, you got your script with you? And I said, yeah. He says, well, can I have it? So I gave him the copy of the script back. He says, listen, he says, you check. We're sending it over to your agent. He says, a tremendous job. We won't forget you. I said, excuse me. I said, Mr. Clifford, what the hell was all that? Oh, he said, didn't you know it? Didn't Mr. Gumpox tell you what it was? I said, no. He said, well, you see, these are the top sales representatives, the regional sales representatives of the company. I said, what company? And he named one of the three major automotive companies. I'll put it that way. I said, really? What was I supposed to be doing? He said, oh, you were one of the design engineers from the factory, and we were trying to get their approval of the this new engine that we're going to put in next year's car, and these guys have to really approve of this whole thing or forget it. It's going to cost us $28 million. We put a lot of dough into this research project. I said, but why did you have an engineer? Well, he says, have you ever listened to an engineer for 5 minutes? There's no engineer in the world that can talk for more than 3 minutes about his own name without getting his tongue all tangled up in his teeth. I said, oh, I see. He said, yeah. I said, listen, he said, if we never need you again, be sure to leave your name with Manny down there. I said, because we'd love to. You were great. So I walked down the street. There I went. Automotive. Mechanical engineer. 35 minutes. And I held them in thrall. By the way, most of these guys were engineers sitting down. That made me wonder. Ever since that time, I've wondered about experts that I've been sitting down listening to from time to time, delivering expertise on television, to write books with Johnny Carson plugs. Every actor that I know of, and let's face it, friends, you better accept the fact I am a bat. I am an actor. That every actor I know has stored in his head millions of, not millions, not really, but he's got dozens of scripts that he wants memorized, and they're there in his head. Now, if you stop him on the street and say, give me scene one from Act Two of Richard II, I have to hear the part of the lion. He couldn't give it to you right away. But when he begins to sing, it slowly comes back. And almost instantaneously, it's all there in complete pristine glory. And if I thought long enough about this, I could deliver the entire lecture to you. All I needed was the slides. The slides were kind of a nice touch. I liked the one that said, and now would you please give me slide 12, please? And on came the slide. I said, you'll notice this is Graham, gentlemen, but our accounting department, along with the drafting department, is prepared to show you the differences in cost overages in the last 7 years related to the use of the magnesium alloy camshaft. The percentile of breakdown is here in this left, the green bar. You'll notice the percentile of returned equipment is in the red bar, and the blue represents our basic percentile margin of profit over the old turned steel camshaft. Now, this is a somewhat inaccurate chart because I personally see several mistakes here myself, but in general, it's fine. And it should give you a nice idea. Oh, I thought that was so nice. A lot of little touches there. So beware of Dr. Myron Fox. Beware.